Imagine for a second that you are walking into a house. You haven't even taken off your coat yet,
We're just barely through the door.
right? And you're instantly hit by this incredibly warm, earthy smell. It's the smell of something just really substantial and comforting cooking over an open fire.
Oh, absolutely. The kind of smell that just instantly makes your mouth water.
Exactly. But then underneath that heavy warmth, there's this like sharp, tangy scent of fermented greens hitting the air.
Yeah, followed by that quiet, rhythmic sizzle of a rich relish coming together in a pan.
Just, hearing that description kind of activates the salivary glands. It's this culinary greeting that speaks to you way before anyone in the kitchen even says a word.
It really does. It sets the stage for the whole meal before a plate is even on the table.
And that specific mouth-watering greeting is the heart of today's deep dive. We are pulling from a truly fascinating piece of cultural and culinary writing.
Yes, it's a March 2026 article by Majorie Lupia.
Right, from the Zambian Food Magazine. And it is beautifully titled, A Taste of Tradition on the Table.
It's a fantastic read because, the mission today isn't just to look at a menu.
No, not at all. We are exploring a much bigger question here. We're looking at how a traditional culture in a perfectly balanced, like ecologically sustainable and chemically complex meal.
And doing all of that generations before the invention of modern nutritional science.
Exactly. The author treats the traditional Zambian meal not as some random assortment of ingredients, but as a highly evolved ecosystem.
Yeah, every single item on the plate serves a specific structural, nutritional, and flavor balancing purpose.
It's like if you remove one element, the entire architecture of the meal just completely collapses.
It really is an architecture. It's built from the ground up.
Okay, let's unpack this by starting at the very foundation of that architecture. Because before you can understand the complex chemistry of Zambian relishes, you have to understand the canvas they are served on.
Right, you need the caloric base.
Huh.
You were talking about the non-negotiable anchor of the Zambian table, which is nishima.
Nishima. Yeah. And for anyone unfamiliar with it, this is a thick, smooth porridge made from finely ground white maize meal cooked with water.
Though, honestly, describing it as porridge almost does it a disservice.
It does, yeah. It's
Yeah.
much firmer than what you think of as porridge.
Exactly. It's worked over the heat until it reaches this very characteristic, stiff, moldable consistency.
And what's wild is that Zambian cooks don't use a thermometer or a timer for this.
No, they just know.
Oh,
They
yeah.
feel the exact moment the starch gelatinizes simply by the physical resistance against the cooking stick.
That tactile nature of Nishima is what stands out immediately to me. I mean, this isn't a dish you passively consume by just stabbing it with a metal fork.
You have to physically engage with it.
Right. The traditional technique is you take a small piece with your hands,
Yeah.
roll it in your palm to smooth it out.
And then you press a hollow into the center of it with your thumb.
Yes. You make a little indentation and then use that hollowed out piece to scoop up your relish.
It's brilliant design, really.
I just love thinking about Nishima as the ultimate edible multi-tool. It is simultaneously your plate, your silverware, and the ultimate comfort carb all rolled into one perfect little bite.
You don't just eat Nishima, you use Nishima to eat the rest of the meal.
Exactly.
What's fascinating here is the underlying culinary architecture you just touched on. Nishima, on its own, is just a simple carbohydrate.
Right, it's just maize and water.
Yeah, it provides the immediate energy, the caloric base, and that physical structural vehicle for the meal. But a diet consisting solely of a simple maize carbohydrate is, nutritionally incomplete.
It lacks the fats and the dense proteins required to actually sustain human health over the long term.
Exactly. And this is where the meal's engineering begins to reveal itself. It brings in what the article calls the silent
The
supporters.
silent supporters, I love that phrasing. And she's specifically talking about cassava and groundnuts here, right?
Yes. Cassava makes sense as a supplementary carbohydrate. It's a starchy root that can be soaked, boiled, or dried and ground into flour to offer a totally different texture.
But the groundnuts, which, just to clarify for everyone, are peanuts. They seem to be doing some incredibly heavy lifting in this cuisine.
Oh, they are the hidden structural pillars of the meal. You might see groundnuts roasted and eaten whole as a snack,
Sure, like anywhere else, yeah.
but their real superpower emerges when they are pounded into a fine powder and integrated directly into the vegetable or meat relishes.
Okay, we need to look at the physical mechanism of what happens when you pound a groundnut because it's so cool. You aren't just making the pieces smaller.
No, you are physically crushing the plant cell walls. And by doing that, you're forcing the natural oils to release.
So it's basically an emulsification process.
Exactly.
Instead of having this like watery vegetable broth sitting next to your Nishima, you introduce this pounded net powder. And those released fats bind with the water in the relish.
You are essentially turning a thin cooking liquid into a rich, creamy sauce. A sauce that can actually cling to your edible maize multi-tool.
Wow. And that physical transformation is matched by a dramatic nutritional transformation, isn't it?
Completely. By adding pounded groundnuts to a relish, you take a simple carbohydrate base and suddenly you're wrapping it in dense plant-based protein and slow-burning healthy fats.
So you have naturally solved the macronutrient deficit of the maize without needing to rely on large amounts of meat.
Which is incredibly efficient.
That structural combination of carb and fat is brilliant, but it leaves an obvious gap for me. We have the scoop, we have the enriched sauce, but what is the primary protein?
Ah, yes. This takes us to the most nutrient-dense and honestly, probably the most surprising element on the table for some, ifinkubala.
Ifinkubala. Okay, for anyone who grew up in Zambia, particularly in the Copper Belt or Eastern regions, this requires absolutely zero explanation.
Right, it is an absolute staple.
But for everyone else, we are talking about caterpillars, primarily harvested from the mopane tree.
The mopane caterpillar, yes.
I have to stop you there, because we kind of need to address the elephant in the room, or, well, I guess the insect on the plate.
Fair enough. It's a big cultural shift for some people.
In the modern Western world, there is this massive push right now by tech startups trying to, quote-unquote, reinvent sustainable protein.
Oh, right. The insect powders.
Exactly. They're spending millions in pristine laboratories grinding crickets into these flavorless, invisible protein powders.
And putting them in sleek, minimalist packaging, right?
Yeah, trying to basically trick people into eating bugs to save the planet. But actually, looking down at a whole caterpillar on your plate is a huge mental hurdle for a lot of people outside of this culture.
It definitely is.
So the question is, does this actually taste good, or is this just an acquired taste born out of historical necessity?
It is a genuinely celebrated flavor profile, but getting there requires understanding the preparation. These aren't just pulled from a tree and tossed onto a plate.
Right. Nobody is eating them raw.
No. Historically, without the luxury of modern refrigeration, a seasonal bounty of protein like mopane caterpillars presented a massive preservation problem.
How do you keep this highly perishable, nutrient-dense food edible year-round?
Exactly. So the indigenous solution was to harvest them, boil them in salted water, and then aggressively sun-dry or smoke them over a fire.
So the smoke acts as a natural preservative, sealing the protein and preventing it from spoiling.
But it also fundamentally alters the taste. We aren't dealing with a bland powdered supplement here.
No. The article describes the texture, once they were rehydrated and fried with onions and tomatoes, as meaty and slightly smoky.
And think about how that specific preparation solves a culinary problem on the plate.
Oh, because of the Nishima.
Yes. You have the soft, yielding, almost neutral canvas of the Nishima. If you pair that with a soft, mushy protein, the meal becomes totally one-dimensional and unappealing.
You need physical resistance.
Exactly. The meaty, chewy texture of the smoked ifinkubala provides a necessary textural counterpoint.
And it's working with the environment rather than fighting it, too. You mentioned these are harvested from the mopane tree.
Right.
That means nobody is clearing thousands of acres of pristine forest to raise cattle. Nobody is degrading the topsoil or diverting rivers to water livestock.
They are literally just looking up at the forest canopy and harvesting a naturally occurring renewable resource during its specific season.
Yeah. Majorie Lupia writes that ifinkubala is, quote, quietly ahead of the curve. And when you look at the ecological footprint compared to industrial beef farming, it's hard to argue with that.
It really forces a reevaluation of what we consider an advanced food system, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Is it more advanced to genetically modify a cow and feed it corn grown with synthetic fertilizers? Or is it more advanced to integrate your diet seamlessly into the natural life cycle of the surrounding forest?
I mean, when you put it like that.
The mopane caterpillar provides an astonishing density of iron, protein, and healthy fats with an environmental cost that is practically zero.
But let's look at the palate fatigue this creates. If I sit down and eat a massive plate of heavy starch coated in a rich, fat-heavy groundnut sauce alongside deeply savory smoked caterpillars.
Your taste buds are going to be exhausted.
Totally exhausted after like 10 minutes. It's just too much weight. Emil needs brightness to cut through all of that savory depth.
And that physical sensation of palate fatigue is exactly why the vegetable relishes are non-negotiable.
They aren't just side dishes.
Not at all. They are the necessary acidic and earthy counterweights to the heavy proteins and starches. And the two primary examples the author highlights are Makalobwa and Lumanda.
Makalobwa is so fascinating to me because it addresses another massive historical problem, which is food security.
Yes, the dried horned melon.
Right, Cucumis metuliferus. The article describes it as an ingredient that appears humble but, quote, rewards patience.
Because it is dried for preservation, it becomes this incredibly reliable, affordable source of nutrition that is available in rural communities all year round.
Totally independent of the harvest season.
Exactly. But you can't just toss a dried melon into a quick stir fry.
No, it would be like chewing on bark. It requires slow cooking, usually with tomatoes and onions, until it breaks down into this thick, deeply earthy stew.
So Makalobwa provides the grounding, earthy flavor profile. But as you pointed out, we still need to solve the problem of palate fatigue. We need something to wake up the mouth.
Enter Lumanda.
Yes. This is a traditional sour leaf vegetable from the roselle plant, which shares a family with sorrel.
And its primary job on the plate is to bring this sharp, fermented tartness. It is the acidic strike that cleanses the palate.
Acid actually triggers the salivary glands. When you eat something heavy, the fats physically coat your tongue, which dulls your taste receptors.
Oh, interesting. So a sharp acid, like the natural tartness of Lumanda leaves.
It physically cuts through that lipid coating. It prepares your mouth to actually taste the next bite of the smoked caterpillar or the rich groundnut sauce.
So it makes a heavy, calorically dense meal feel paradoxically light and dynamic.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We're talking about cooking tough, sun-dried horned melons and highly fibrous sour leaves.
Two very tough ingredients, yeah.
If you just boil those in standard water, you're going to be standing over a fire for 12 hours waiting for them to become remotely chewable.
You'd be cooking all day. But Zambian cooks bypass that entirely by using bicarbonate of soda.
Baking soda. They add it directly to the cooking water to soften these ingredients.
This is perhaps the most elegant example of indigenous food science in the entire meal. Both the dried Makalobwa and the fresh Lumanda leaves contain tough plant cell walls.
Constructed primarily out of complex carbohydrates called cellulose and pectin, right?
Correct. And in neutral water, those structures take an incredibly long time to break down.
Wait, if they're adding baking soda to the water, doesn't that completely ruin the flavor profile?
Why would it?
Well, baking soda is highly alkaline. I would imagine adding it to a stew would make the whole thing taste metallic or soapy or just completely neutralize that beautiful tartness of the Lumanda we just talked about.
And that is the genius of the measurement and the chemistry. You aren't adding enough to turn the dish into soap. You're adding just enough to act as a chemical skeleton key.
A skeleton key.
Yes. By slightly raising the pH of the cooking liquid, turning it alkaline, you trigger a chemical reaction that rapidly dismantles the rigid scaffolding of the pectin and cellulose.
Oh, wow. So instead of boiling the vegetables into a gray, mushy oblivion for hours.
Well, it would destroy all the water-soluble vitamins anyway.
Right. The alkaline water chemically unlocks the plant structure. It softens the tough fibers quickly, releasing the trapped nutrients and flavors into the relish while preserving the integrity of the dish.
That isn't just a cooking hack. That is applied chemistry passed down through generations of cooks who observed how wood ash, which was an early source of alkalinity, interacted with tough vegetables.
It highlights a really deep empirical understanding of the natural world. They identified a chemical barrier, tough plant cell walls, and engineered a precise alkaline solution to overcome it.
Maximizing both digestibility and nutritional extraction. But beyond the chemistry, though, the author notes the profound psychological effect these specific flavors have.
Yeah, she talks about the emotional weight of the food.
For anyone who grew up eating it, that sharp, acidic bite of Lumanda carries a heavy dose of nostalgia. It evokes memories of a grandmother's kitchen, the unhurried pace of a Sunday meal, and a profound sense of home.
Just think about what you had for lunch today. Was it a highly processed sandwich wrapped in plastic, engineered in a corporate lab for maximum shelf life, and eaten in your car?
For a lot of people, the answer is yes.
Right. Or was it a meal built for actual sustained nutrition, utilizing local ecology and carrying generations of cultural memory? Marjorie Lupia's article ends by zooming out to look at the broader global food landscape.
And it paints a very stark contrast between those two realities. We are living through an era of rapid food globalization.
The prevailing narrative, which is heavily marketed by fast food chains and multinational food conglomerates, suggests that faster is inherently better.
Yeah, that imported ingredients are a status symbol, and that traditional indigenous food systems are just relics of a less developed past.
But the article entirely rejects that premise. It concludes by stating that preparing and eating a traditional spread, taking the time to mold the nishima, to pound the ground nuts, to balance the tart lumanda against the earthy makalabwa, is a, quote, quiet act of pride.
The author boldly declares, our food is enough. It is more than enough.
That statement is a radical pushback against culinary imperialism. It demands respect for an indigenous food system that managed to solve the complex problems of macronutrient balance, year-round food security, and environmental sustainability.
And it solved them long before those concepts were trending topics in Western universities.
So what does this all mean? To me, it means these dishes are literal stories of resilience encoded in flavor.
Absolutely.
They represent an incredibly sophisticated understanding of chemistry, like using an alkaline solution to dismantle pectin. And they're working models of environmental harmony, you know, relying on the seasonal harvest of mopane caterpillars instead of destructive industrial agriculture.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this Zambian menu exposes the arrogance of assuming modern, industrialized diets are the pinnacle of human achievement.
It really does.
It proves that culinary sophistication isn't defined by imported luxury ingredients or lab-engineered proteins.
No, it is defined by a culture's ability to look at its immediate environment, understand the chemical and nutritional properties of what grows there, and synthesize those elements into a balanced, sustaining, and deeply comforting meal. It's an ecosystem on a plate. It truly proves that the most satisfying meals don't just feed the body. They tell a story of exactly where we come from and how our ancestors learned to thrive.
Which leaves you with a lingering question to consider the next time you sit down to eat.
Oh, I like this. What is it?
If traditional diets like this Zambian spread naturally solved the intricate puzzles of nutritional balance, flavor pairing, and environmental sustainability centuries ago, what forgotten traditional foods from your own ancestral background are waiting to be rediscovered right now rather than being quietly replaced by globalized fast food?